I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Trace your finger down the northeast coastline of Africa, across the salty Red Sea from Saudi Arabia and Yemen, along that low, flat African shoreline. What we're talking about is one of the principal borders of the country of Eritrea. And while it's not an impressive piece of property, it is changing, ever so slightly, under the guidance of a man named Gordon Sato. For close to 20 years, Sato's been working to green the coast of Eritrea. Now, this wasn't his original life's work. Gordon Sato is a premier cell biologist, one of the men who devised the cancer drug Erbitux. Now, he's cultivating the mangroves on the African coastline. His project is named Manzanar, which happens to be the same name given to the Japanese-American internment camp where he was sent as a youth. And under that hot sun in the California prison, he taught himself to grow food. Now, he's hoping to feed a people struck by drought halfway around the world. I'd like to ask you to join my conversation this hour with Gordon Sato. What do you think it is that drives a person to help others? How much difference would it make if more people had the time or the inclination to aid people in places in the world? Maybe we can take this one as a lesson in Thanksgiving that goes a bit beyond the traditional family gathering. What do you think? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And just a note before I introduce Mr. Sato, I'd like you to have a look at our website, theconnection.org. We've put together a photo gallery of that Eritrean coastline, Gordon Sato working with the local people there, planting the mangroves. There is also a link there to his own website. That's mangroveproject.com. Gordon Sato's here with me in the Connection studio. Thank you so much for coming in.
It's manzanarproject.com.
What did I say?
Mangrove Project.
Oh, thank you for that. manzanarproject.com. The website has it right. They always get it right. I'm the one who's likely to mess it up here. Tell me when you were last there.
About 6 months ago.
And what did it look like? How was it coming along?
Oh, it's coming along beautifully.
Tell me what I would see if I were there.
Well, you'd come to a coastline that is most often bare with no green whatsoever.
No rocks, just a sort of muddy, sandy,
muddy, flat.
Yeah.
And we've converted it to a green forest.
Was there ever anything there?
No, where we have planted trees, there were no trees before. There's nothing there.
So the first time you saw it, it was a pretty desolate piece of coastline.
Yeah, well, there are trees in sparse areas.
Right.
But we can fill the whole coast.
And what's the point? Why would you want to do that?
Well, these are people that are very poor. They don't have much money, they don't have much food, they don't have much water, and their housing is miserable. And I think we can create wealth, or they can create wealth themselves.
Take me through that. The mangroves on the coastline begin what process in your mind?
Serve as food for animals, all right? We cut the leaves and wash off the salt with seawater. We collect the seeds, the mangroves, and we soak them in water and seawater till the cover comes off, and then we sun-dry them. It forms a grain that is stable for a couple of years. So the seeds and the leaves form a food for the animals, but it's not sufficient, okay? And what we found is we have to add a small amount of, we use right now a commercial feed made by the Blue Seal Company called sheep stress food. And it has principally fat-soluble vitamins. And we give a little bit of this with the leaves and the seeds of mangroves, and it's adequate food for animals. Now we're searching for additives to the food that we can produce locally. And I think one possibility is fish meal. Another possibility is around the world, rice bran is thrown away to make white rice. And that would make an excellent supplement to our food. And its price is almost nothing.
There's something else that of course would happen with that that strip of mangrove trees along the tidal coastline in Eritrea, and that's what happens to the sea there. Could that possibly provide new forms of food or protein as well?
Oh, yes. I mean, right now it's obvious that the seas where our trees are planted are enriched for fish, okay? And the way the trees enrich the seas for fishes is the leaves fall in the water. They're decomposed by microorganisms, and microorganisms are eaten by little organisms, and on until fish eat them. And so forests enrich the sea.
If you were to wade into the oldest mangrove swamp that you've got along that coastline, would you see now any brine shrimp or crabs, that sort of thing?
Yeah, we see crabs and little fishes that we never saw before. And crabs are... especially fiddler crabs are very numerous, and there were none, well, very little before. So no doubt we're enriching the sea. But our main benefit, economic benefit, is feeding animals.
I'm fascinated to know how ever you came by the inspiration to do this in the first place. I mean, for a long period in your life, you were this cell biologist, high-flying American scientist working in universities, teaching graduate students, and that stopped and this began. What happened?
Well, there was a famine in Ethiopia.
I remember it well.
And I investigated the matter and found out it was Eritrean famine, because the central government, the Ethiopian government, was starving out the rebels. So I went into Eritrea through the Sudan, and, you know, this limited areas.
When did you make this trip?
In 1987.
Because there were still fighting in the
1980s.
Yeah,
there were still fighting, yes. Yeah, it was, at the time I didn't think it was dangerous, but in retrospect,
should have kept your head down.
Yeah.
But, you know, Gordon, when most people saw those television pictures of the famine, mm-hmm. they wrote a check.
Yeah.
You know, they gave money to Oxfam or to CARE or to MSF, to the people who were in there helping. And I need you to take this another step for me. Why did you choose to do so much more?
Well, because... you know, there's the old saying, you give a man fish and he can eat for a day, but you teach him how to fish, he can feed himself. And what we're trying to do is make these people self-sufficient. We're providing the means for them to be self-sufficient. They can produce their own food and wealth. And that's my long-term ambition.
I mentioned in introducing you that when you were just a teenager, you were in one of the Japanese internment camps in California. This would have been, what, 1942, 43?
Yeah, mm-hmm. In 44.
How long were you there?
About 2 years.
With your family?
Yeah.
And there were people in that internment camp, it was pretty well a desert too, wasn't it?
Yes.
And there were people in that camp who were growing their own food?
Yes, we had streams there from the mountains nearby. In fact, that area used to be a rich agriculture area until Los Angeles took away the water.
What were you growing?
I was growing corn and radishes and tomatoes, yeah.
Was it a bit of a challenge for you or something to occupy your time? How do you look back on that?
It was a challenge, you know.
Getting the water or getting the seed? I don't know. I mean, I have very little idea of exactly what it was like for you at the time.
No, it wasn't so difficult. But I think being in Manzanar and having poor food got me thinking about how to produce food where food wasn't being produced. And that's what I'm doing in Eritrea.
And you have named your project in Eritrea. You've given it the same name that the camp had in California. I was curious about that.
Well, I want to memorialize Manzanar. I want to turn it into something positive. All right. And, Yeah, we were people that can make a contribution to the world. And at that time, we were thought of as nothing.
It's interesting. I'm trying to imagine what goes through your mind, and I'm going to ask you to tell me, so I'm not sitting here speculating, but you have all these people, Japanese Americans, who are working at every level of the society, who on a given day are told, no, you don't count as people anymore. We're going to lock you away in this internment camp. All of a sudden, you become, you know, insignificant in the eyes of the country. And I guess, and I'm wondering if that shift from being ordinary, contributing citizens of a country, to suddenly finding yourself considered, you know, lower than citizens, in some way inspired you when you look at Africa and you see the way that we or the rest of the world would regard people like the Eritreans.
Yeah. Well, that, in general, that's wrong. Of course, Manzanar had a big psychological effect on me. It was a humiliating experience. And I'm happy to say that it's over. And, you know, Japanese Americans have, are in the life of America to quite some extent. I mean, at one time there were 3 senators of Japanese ancestry, 3% of the senators, and we represent about 0.1% of the people. And right now we have a cabinet minister, the Minister of Transportation, and the past chief of staff of the U.S. Army was General Shinseki. So America's changed. And I think America's a great country. It can evolve.
You left the camp, worked as a gardener for a while, did you not?
Yes.
Once you were outside as well, before going back to school and becoming a graduate student?
Yeah.
So were you always somehow attached to what it is you could grow, what it is you could create from nothing?
Probably. That's what I've been doing in science, too. Yeah.
My guest this hour is Gordon Sato. Years, as I said earlier, as a premier cell biologist in the country, a contributor to the creation of one of the most highly regarded cancer drugs, and not at the end of, but in the midst of a very high-profile career. He stopped doing that, moved to the other side of the world, and for almost the past 20 years has been helping the people in Eritrea transform their own coastline to give people there a chance that they didn't have. We're going to talk a little bit more about what's changed in Eritrea when we come back. We'd also like to hear from you about this kind of career change and whether or not there is the place and the time and the space in most people's lives to do this sort of thing. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. My guest this hour is Gordon Sato. He founded the Manzanar Project. You can see more about what they're doing on the coast of Eritrea by going to our website. We're at theconnection.org. You'll see a photo gallery there of the mangrove planting that's underway, as well as find a link to Gordon's site. That's themanzanarproject.com. When we were talking earlier, Gordon, about actually going to Africa for the first time, did you go with a pile of money into Eritrea? What were you hoping to do at that time?
I didn't know, but I was optimistic, and optimism paid off. The way it paid off was my wife read an article about a Japanese gentleman, Shingo Nomura, who faced hunger at the end of World War II, and was very grateful for American food aid.
Huh.
And for that, he wanted to help people who are suffering from famine. So my ex-students in Japan arranged an interview for me, and they thought I already knew him. And so they said, Professor Sato has only 1 hour to see you. You must appear in his lobby at exactly 9 o'clock, and he can only see you to 10. And this man came and listened to me for 1 hour, and he had a notebook, was taking notes. At the end of the hour, he says, what do you want? I said, I want $500,000. He says, okay. And I said, what? Don't you want to check on me? He said, not necessary. And the truth is, I talked to his employees years later. He didn't check on me. And that one interview convinced him. And with that, I was able to help the Eritreans fighting their war quite a bit.
Something about trust.
Yeah.
Being able to look somebody in the eye and know that they're telling you the truth. A lot of people, though, go off with great ideas to make a difference. And a lot of people succeed and a lot of people fail. Did you have to work hard to persuade the Eritreans that it was a good idea, number one? And number two, you were going to stick around for 20 years to make sure that it worked.
Yeah, it was hard. To solve physical problems in this world, the science is the easiest part. It's the politics that are most difficult. I had to convince layers of bureaucrats to allow me to do this. But I think they're pretty well convinced now.
They are now.
Yeah.
Let's take a call from Amherst, Massachusetts. A reminder to our listeners, you'd like to join my conversation, we're at 1-800-423-TALK. And Johannes is with us. Hi, Johannes.
Yes.
Thank you for calling. Tell me what you're thinking.
I first of all want to thank Professor Sato for what he's doing for Eritrea. I am from Eritrea myself.
Oh, welcome.
And in 1987, when he went to Eritrea, things were hopeful, and there was a lot of enthusiasm for the future of the country. I am in complete support of his project, although I have questions about maybe what kind of environmental impact, the project has. But my question is a little bit of a political one, and I can understand if you don't want to comment about this issue so as not to jeopardize your project there. But the regime's human rights record has become terrible, and it has deteriorated to the point where it would be a reminder of your situation in World War II. Young people are being rounded up and being shot as we speak in Eritrea. And so I was wondering if, he can say something about the human rights situation in the country.
Well, rather than asking Professor Sato to make a political comment on that, I mean, why don't we find out how you keep working in places where the politics can change so much and be so dodgy. Fair enough?
I suppose, yes.
Okay. My approach is to work with villagers, and so I have very little to do with the central government. And my hope is that we can make life so good for local villagers that, the government will never interfere.
Do you worry, though, that even the best meaning, most well-meaning projects can be jeopardized by the politics that you were talking about earlier?
Well, right now, the politicians don't pay much attention to us.
Which is a good thing.
Which is a good thing. And I hope it stays that way.
One of the things we haven't explored a little bit, and you've just touched on it here, and we should talk about that a bit before we go back to the calls, and that is that this is not Gordon Sato like Johnny Appleseed all by himself on the mudflats of the Red Sea coastline. How many local people are involved in this project?
Oh, we have about 50 to 75 people, and they're excellent.
These are men, women, farmers, livestock people?
Mostly women in the village, and and some men in the village, and they're uneducated. Most of our women probably haven't had a day of schooling. Our supervisors have had seventh grade education and third grade education, but they are intelligent, they're hardworking, they're conscientious, they're trustworthy, they're everything one could ask from an employee.
Are they paid?
Yes.
And they're paid out of the money that you gather as, or?
Yeah, they're paid.
We'll leave it at that. But I think it's probably interesting to note and important for our listeners to know that you've put a lot of your own money into
yes.
this as well. It's not just the money from a philanthropist in Japan, but a lot of your money's in
yes.
this project as well.
Yeah, that's true.
You also won a $100,000 Rolex award for this type of award, an enterprise award. I guess some of that money wound up in Eritrea.
Yes, it did.
As well. Gordon Sato is my guest. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Your chance to join us next to Tiffany, who's calling in from Lynn, Massachusetts. Hi, Tiffany.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
First, I just want to say that, Professor Sato, I am really inspired by your work, and I read about your story in the Boston Globe last week. And my question to you is this. How much do you think that your ability to go out and help the people in Eritrea is a direct result of the fact that you've had such a wonderful professional career first? I, too, have experienced adversity in my life, although not to the extent that you have, and I teach at a community college, so I see a lot of students who've seen a lot of adversity. And it seems to me that very often they need to make something of themselves before they can then think about going out to help others. And I wonder if that's true for you as well.
Yes, it is true. I mean, the fact that I have a reputation as a scientist gives me access to a lot of people. Let's see, what was the other question?
Well, it also has to do with personally, when you make the choice to do something as dramatic as you did in moving to Eritrea, does that come at a stage in your life where you say, I've done this one thing that I had planned on doing, and now it's time to do something else?
Well, what I think is that people who do laboratory science are really the people best equipped to go out and solve practical problems. And so for me to solve practical problems, how do you grow mangrove trees? How do you use them to feed animals? They're very simple conceptually compared to things that I've done in the laboratory. And I'm hopeful that that scientists in general, or many of them, will find this a good way to cap your career.
And in fairness here now, as simple as it is to get a mangrove tree growing healthily on the coastline of Eritrea, it didn't just happen with the first one you stuck in the ground. You had to do a lot of trial and error with how you... explain how the fertilizer works. I think this is interesting.
Trees only grow in Eritrea in certain areas called mersas, where fresh water flows into the sea. And I think people in the past have thought that fresh water is what was necessary for the trees. But we figured out that the fresh water, what is doing is bringing fertilizer from the land. And so we examined seawater to see what's missing that the fresh water has to bring. And seawater lacks nitrogen, phosphorus, and iron. And so we figured that in areas where there's not fresh water bringing nitrogen, phosphorus, and iron to trees, if we furnished it, the trees would flourish. And we devised a way of delivering the fertilizer. We put it in a plastic bag and seal it and puncture three holes so that the fertilizer...
Not two holes, not four holes, but
no,
three holes?
But three. And we did experiments to find out the optimum number of holes. And this delivers fertilizer at just the rate that the trees need. And so it results in no fertilizer runoff. And that was, I think, probably the first time this has ever been done. And we've measured fertilizer runoff offshore from our plantings, and there is none. Then the next thing we had to do is we had to figure out how to make the trees nutritious for animals. And we fed the animals leaves and seeds, and they didn't grow very much. And then we found that we just had to supplement the food with a little commercial feed, blue seal sheep stress food, and that made the food perfectly adequate.
Now, the oldest tree on that coastline now is how old?
The oldest tree that we planted is about 5 years old, and it's about 15 feet tall.
Which is a pretty healthy mangrove tree.
Oh, yes.
And
oh,
long
yes.
past the stage where it would be feeding up from that fertilizer bag?
Oh, we have to replenish the fertilizer. Every 3 years, we have to add fertilizer back. And we could make this period longer, but we don't have the money to put more fertilizer in the bags. We could put enough fertilizer so it lasts 10 years. But we can't afford it at the moment.
Do you think there'll ever come a time when these mangrove swamps, though, are self-supporting, where they don't need that kind of help from people?
I doubt it. I doubt it.
Is that a weakness in the project?
No, because the cost of fertilizing the trees is very little. It's about $100 a hectare per year. And I figure that the trees will probably earn for the people about $1,500 a year from animals.
So tell me what you say to people like Johannes who raise a question about how you are altering a piece of land which has never had trees before, and whether or not this is a, you know, sort of bio shock for the region, or could be.
Yeah, well, just look at the world. We have agriculture all over the world, and at one time we didn't have agriculture all over the world. And would you say that we've ruined the world by filling the
planting corn in Iowa?
Yeah.
So you look at it as agriculture,
yes.
The same kind of effect on the land.
And the thing is, it's seawater agriculture is at the stage where freshwater agriculture was maybe, 500 years ago.
I hadn't even thought about it in that terms, yeah. But seawater agriculture, mangroves, some seagrasses, I guess.
We'd like to grow, you see, in the salt marshes of Massachusetts and Maine and New Hampshire, it's filled with miles and miles of grass, spartina. And this is cut to produce hay for cows, all right? That would be a great boon in Eritrea.
Have you tried it?
We're trying it.
Let's go to another call. To Carson City, Michigan, David's joining us on the line. Hi, David.
Hi. I was curious what your opinion is on biotechnology for solving some of the food production problems in the third world.
You mean genetic engineering, David? Is that what you're talking about?
No, genetic engineering, sure. I'm an agronomist in Michigan, and I'm always surprised at the level of misinformation and ignorance that we have towards biotechnology and genetic engineering in this country even, and it just seems to hold a tremendous amount of potential for solving some of the problems in the third world. And from your perspective, what you think the potential is.
Okay. I find that most of the opposition to genetic engineering comes from people who earn a good deal of money from being in opposition to genetic engineering. Now, the tomato that doesn't rot, that was produced in this country because it might, and it was opposed because it might have allergens. It is the common tomato of South Africa. In South Africa, everybody grows this tomato. It's the only tomato grown. It's amazing. It never rots. And it seems to me that's a good test. There is no illness from the tomato.
So would you ever go back into the lab and do a little genetic tinkering with a mangrove sprout and say, hey, we've got one that requires less iron or less nitrogen?
The thing is, I don't have enough time. I would love to do that, but I don't have enough time.
Is the science there for that now?
Well, the science is there for other things that we're doing. We're making algae that grow with sugar and can feed fish. And I think I can fill the coastal waters of any country with fish and very economically.
Is this the fish farming, the thing, the net, the offshore nets? Those are pretty controversial in some areas.
Yeah, but the thing is, the way it's done is you take fish in a net, a cage, and you feed them dead food, all right? And they don't eat some of it. And the food that they don't eat gives rise to microorganisms like bacteria. And it pollutes the sea, all right? What we do is we grow algae and feed it to brine shrimp. And the brine shrimp clean up the sea. They serve as food, live food for fishes, and they don't pollute the sea. They clean the sea. And I'm sure I'm going to have a lot of trouble from people who say I shouldn't change things.
David, are you still there with us from Carson City?
Yes, I am.
Maybe that's a part of persuading people how this can work, is to have that kind of sort of practical explanation or ways of mitigating some of the effects, right?
Well, I see biotechnology in this country as just having tremendous environmental and economic benefits for producers, and that seems to all be pushed to the wayside with just scenarios that people come up with to scare the public about these advances. And you know, I think the tomato example is just really just a small fraction of what we're doing today, and how applicable that would be in the third world right now. That people won't take this technology and use it because of really a fear that's been put into them. And
David, I'm going to stop you there if you don't mind. And just a reminder to our listeners, we're not actually going to debate the merits and the problems of genetic engineering on this program. In fact, what we're talking about is one man's idea, one man's project to take the already well-established mangrove and introduce it into a part of the world and perhaps make life better for the people who are there, and whether or not people, in fact, think about doing the sort of things themselves. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. My guest this hour is Gordon Sato. He left a high-profile scientific career in the United States, where he's working as a cell biologist, to spend close to the last 20 years of his life working with people in Eritrea. He is 76 years old now, soon to be 77. You can find some photos of his Manzanar cultivation project in Eritrea on our website. We're at theconnection.org. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join us. We're taking our next call now from Charlotte, North Carolina. Jim's with us. Hi, Jim.
Hello, and hello to Gordon.
Do you two know each other?
Well, Gordon, I was a student of yours at Brandeis many, many years ago, and I came as a physician to the biochemistry department, and I just wanted you to know that you've been a hero to me for a very long time, and I'm thrilled to hear about all the things that you're doing. And I've had a similar culmination of my career in that I've devoted my efforts to improving the health status of Native Americans. But I'm absolutely thrilled by all the work that you've done, and I think you've set standards for all of us in all branches of science and medicine. And I just wanted to say thank you.
Well, I'm very pleased to hear from you, and gosh, what you're doing with Native Americans is wonderful, and I congratulate you and applaud what you're doing.
Jim, thanks for that call. 1-800-423-8255. Next now to Needham, Massachusetts. Bob's on the line. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Bob. Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
Well, I wanted to share a perspective. Sort of going back to what you were saying at the top of the hour, and then you had a caller saying, talking about, you know, why people would take up this kind of work,
mm-hmm.
What brings somebody to do that. And for me, it was really taking a serious amount of time and effort to think about what I really care about, to really sort of dig deep and put aside all of the materialism in the world and think about what I really care about as a person.
Well, what were you doing and what are you doing now, Bob?
Well, and I was working in the high-tech field. And so I was forced to make a change.
Yeah.
And I thought if I'm going to make a change, I might as well think about what I care about. And what I came to realize is I care about making the world better. And I think that's probably true for many people once they really sort of think about it.
So what are you doing?
I'm working in economic justice and fighting for fair economic policies, fair taxes, that kind of thing.
I wonder, Bob, what you think of people who, I mean, you had your choice handed to you when the bottom dropped out of the high-tech industry. I acknowledge that. But you know, you'll be talking to people on a fairly regular basis who say, gee, that's a cool thing that you're doing, but I couldn't, or I won't, or I wouldn't do the
right.
same thing. What do you say to them?
Well, it's difficult because I think you do have to put aside sort of the commercialism and the materialism that that we have all around us. And really think about, you know, as I say, what you care about. What do you really care about? Not, you know, what car do you want to buy? What house do you want to buy? What college do you want to send your kids to? But what do you really, what do you as a person really care about? And I think many people will say, you know, really, I would like to make the world a better place.
You're getting a smile here in the studio from Gordon mm-hmm. Sato. These the same sorts of thoughts that go through your mind?
Well... I'd like to talk about a conversation I had with William Jenks, a professor at Brandeis, many years ago. You know, he asked me why I was doing science, and I said, it's just great fun. And I asked him, why are you doing science? And he says, it's a duty. And he was a brilliant scientist, and he felt it was his duty to advance human knowledge. Now, I'm at the same point at this stage of life. What I'm doing because I feel it's my duty.
When you use the word duty, do you mean that you have an obligation to look for someone who could use your particular expertise?
No, I don't understand that thing.
Well, you have this scientific skill, and it, yeah. and when you talk about your duty as a scientist, then it's a duty...
No, to use the scientific knowledge
right.
to help people.
That resonate with you there, Bob?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you know when you sort of for me the arc was okay. This is what I care about, and this is what I have to do. This becomes my duty. So it certainly does.
All right. Thanks for your call. 1-800-423-TALK to Columbia, South Carolina. Pat's with us. Hi, Pat.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for
Good
calling.
Morning. Yeah, a couple parts to this question. The first off is, how are you viewed by the larger international aid agencies, and have they offered assistance? And do you see what you're doing as perhaps a model in the future for assisting these impoverished countries where rather than simply use what's there or just keep shipping in food, you actually do, I guess we call it terraforming, you know, creation of an ecosystem that is more suited towards supporting a human population.
Let's take the first question about where your project, your kind of project, fits within all the other aid work that goes on.
No, it doesn't fit with the aid agencies. And my experience is that the bureaucracy of these agencies, the individuals in it are, concerned with their personal fortunes, and they forget the greater goals of the agency.
That would be particularly true of the United Nations. This is one that I've read about. You've
yes.
clashed with them
yeah.
in the past.
Yes.
Why don't they help? Why don't they see what you're doing and saying, you know, that's sort of what we're supposed to be doing as well? I know I'm asking you to analyze, but what's your experience here?
Well, if I look at the UNDP in Eritrea, the head of it comes from one African country, and he works in Eritrea, and he's paid at a European scale, so, and a tremendously high rate. He can save about $2 million in 8 years. And I think what happens is that this becomes the chief concern of these people.
So how, again, just following on Pat's question here, how do you take projects at a smaller scale level like yours and make them a model for the kind of change we're talking about?
Well, I'm trying to make the people self-sufficient, that they should be able to do it themselves. And we're trying to get this project to the point where people can do it themselves and they don't need outside help.
Are they there right now?
Yes, almost.
Hmm. You don't go as much as you used to. You used to spend 6-9 months a year there, but fewer.
I have excellent people in Eritrea. They're really excellent.
And so if you stopped going back, what do you think would happen?
I think they need me right now, and especially they need me in the role of raising money and running interference with the government. But I hope that this need diminishes.
You began the program by talking about how these are a people who were not only ravaged by war, but drought and had all... We didn't make the point perhaps as strongly as we could have that there are no diamond mines in Eritrea. There is no oil that's yet been discovered in Eritrea. The future of that country in many ways relies on the self-sufficiency of the people.
That's right. This country is resource poor, and it was devastated by the war. And so they have to. It's a bootstrap operation.
Is that something which, in your mind, though, distinguishes the Eritreans, that understanding that they're basically going to have to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps, that they're not going to be, you know, helped out by mineral wealth and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think the country understands this.
1-800-423-8255. We're going next to... Misrach, who's joining us from Boston. Hi, Misrach. Nice to hear from you again.
Hi. There are a number of educated and talented Eritreans in the U.S. Who are waiting for change in the government to go and make work on projects or build the economy. I'm asking Professor Soto, what would you advise these people, how they should ignore that and go and make something? What would you say to them?
It's a difficult question. My approach is to work with local people. And I don't worry about macro policy. That's not anything I could do anything about. I just care about helping the people at the local level. I hope...
And you can stay under the radar?
More or less.
Because that's a part of the game, isn't it?
It's part of the
game. Not to be noticed or...
But I'll get more noticed as time goes on. And the government leaves me pretty much alone.
Do you have any way of measuring how the Manzanar project, how the mangroves project along the coastline has changed people at this stage? Are there villages or neighborhoods in that area where you can see a change in the time that you've been there?
Yes. Well, we work in one village primarily. And
that's hidden. What's the name of it?
Hargigo.
Hargigo, yeah.
And what the people do is they cut the mangrove trees to feed their sheep and goats. They didn't do that before. They didn't know the sheep and goats could eat mangroves. They are picking up the seaweed. We've taught them how to collect the seaweed and dry it. And this has been used as a traditional animal food in Ireland and Scotland for hundreds of years. Eritreans didn't know this, and now they're all doing it. And so...
And you know the measures that we use, Gordon, to say how well are people doing there? You know, is there a school? Do the children have the time to go to school? Are those kinds of measures a part of what you're looking at?
No, but I think we want to expand our program to include education. We have workers who haven't had a day of school. And I'm thinking now we can teach them how to read introduce awareness of AIDS. We will have to feel our way to see how this works. And the trouble is, we have to know, if we want to help these people learn to read, we have to know what language to use. And we have Sahos and Tigres and people with different languages. So it's a problem, but we can solve it, I think.
And how has it changed you?
Hmm?
How has this involvement in the project changed you? What have you learned?
Well, I think I feel more self-confident. I figure I have a place in the world. And, I don't have any doubts about this.
Well, I think the work that you're doing is an inspiration to other people who think about this sort of thing and may never get a chance to do it. I want to remind our listeners one more time that if they want a closer look at the work of Gordon Sato, they can check out our website at theconnection.org, where there's a link to his website, the Manzanar Project.com, as well as photos of the work that is underway, even as we speak right now in Eritrea. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I want to thank you so much for coming in. It's been a pleasure having you in the studio.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure talking to you, and I admire your skill as an interviewer.
Hey, you get guests like this. This is pretty easy. Thanks again. Gordon Sato, cell biologist, founder of the Manzanar Project. And as I mentioned, more information about that at our website, theconnection.org. Our program is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, Doug Sugarts, and Kevin Sullivan. Our interns are Sarah Baker, Diana Schoberg, and Killian Nolan. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.